Even if you haven't seen the 1975 movie Jaws, chances are you've heard those menacing tones and a lot of other music written by their composer John Williams, winner of 5 Academy Awards and 21 Grammys, in addition to many other distinctions. John Williams is credited with bringing back the classical Hollywood music style, whether it's a monster or sharks or the evil doings of a Death Star or breathtaking perils above a raging river. John Williams has intensified the scene with music, and it's a feat worthy of Indiana Jones himself, as we'll find out. What enabled Williams to become the best-known composer in Hollywood today? I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. My guest is Emilio Audicino, a researcher at the University of Southampton and author of the book John Williams' Film Music, published in 2014 by the University of Wisconsin Press. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Thank you, Norman. Thank you for inviting me. And hello, everyone.
When we talk about the golden age of Hollywood, and that applies to film music also, that's just one phase, isn't it, of this whole now more than 100-year development?
Yes.
So, I mean, it's tempting to look at the development of film over all those years, but let's look at film music before we look at John Williams and
put him
in context.
Yeah, well, in my book, I sort of place the classical Hollywood music style from 1933 to 1958. The reason for that is that 1933 is the year where King Kong was released, and it has an incredible and groundbreaking Max Steiner score. And actually, it was the film that ushered in the classical symphonic scoring in Hollywood, because before 1933, basically, the approach was to have just what scholars call diegetic music.
Diegetic.
That would be music that has a source within the shot. I mean, there would be some orchestra shown within the shot, or a radio, or a gramophone play music. And so music was generally allowed to be in the film only if you could see the source within the story world.
Quite a literal application of it.
Yeah, because there was a sort of a kind of a realistic poetics. So basically, if music is not within the story world, this big word diegetic mean within the story world of the film, then there was this idea that the audience may ask, what is this music coming from?
Well,
I don't see the source.
You know, and there have been some films that had some fun with that too, aren't there? Where you hear music and then suddenly you pan over and there's an orchestra.
Yeah.
I mean, even Cat Ballou was a little bit that way.
Yeah, and Mel Brooks mm-hmm. used a couple of, for example, High Anxiety. There's a great scene where he's in his car and talking with the chauffeur, and there's been some homicides where there's this clinic, is the head of this clinic, and there are being some homicides. And in that scene, you realize that there might be a killer. And so you hear this threatening, sort of a thriller kind of music. And then you see that Mel Brooks noticed that this music started and said, where is the music coming from? And then you see that at the side of the car is just passing a big coach with the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra playing the music. So this is one of the many gags that have been done. But anyway, to go back to the 1930s, before King Kong, the idea was that non-diegetic music, that is music outside of the story world, it was not good because it was not realistic enough. And that was Max Steiner, mainly with King Kong, that launched this new trend of having non-diegetic music as a comment and accompaniment.
Well, I mean, not much before 1933, 2-3 years before that, you're talking silent pictures anyway, where the film music would serve an entirely different function, wouldn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. That was where there's a scholar, Peter Larson, that wrote that in sound films we have actually film music, in silent cinema we had cinema music, because the music was played within the film theater. And so it was a completely different thing, with a completely different aesthetics.
And sometimes tied directly to the action in the film.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Does it all come from the tradition of writing music for a libretto, for an opera, or for the theater?
Yes, yes, because the Hollywood first generation of composers mainly was a group of composers coming from Europe, and they had this background in opera or operetta. For example, the three big names were Max Steiner, who was Austrian, and he had a background in operetta. The other one was Alfred Newman, who was American, but he made a career arranging music for theater and conducting silent movie orchestras in the silent period. And finally, Korngold, Erich Wolfgang Korngold, and was a big opera star in Vienna.
Oh, in fact, yes, he was a child prodigy, too,
yes,
Korngold
exactly.
was.
Yeah,
he wrote an opera at the age of 12 or something. Played his ballet on the piano for Mahler, and Richard Strauss said good things about him. And then this is the boy who not much later would go to Hollywood and write for the movies.
Sure. So basically, all this first generation brought into Hollywood scoring their expertise in theater and opera scoring, we can say, yeah.
So by the time we get to 1933, we have talkies, we have
yes.
King Kong. And the music now, it's pretty much pervasive through the film at this point?
Sure. Mostly wallpaper kind of music also. And that music was present all throughout the film. So, and also there was, particularly in Max Steiner's scores, this what was called Mickey Mousing.
Yeah, I thought that's a fascinating term.
Yeah, that is that music adds... With the new aesthetics, very non-realistic, we can say, as compared to the pre-1933 aesthetic, was that music had to accompany everything happening on screen. So, for example, Max Steiner was very good at that, for example. If you had someone that was stabbed and it would fall down a flight of stairs, mm-hmm. you would hear a descending scale by the violins doing and accompanying the character falling. And Max Steiner was so precise in catching all these sync points. And that was one of the most evident characteristics of the classical Hollywood scoring.
I can't resist jumping ahead just briefly when you talk about a character getting stabbed and falling downstairs. Of course, I think of Psycho and Bernard Herrmann.
Sure.
So is that the same thing, working with sync points?
Not actually. That's the second generation. Basically, the second generation started working in the 1930s. For example, Bernard Herrmann began his career in Hollywood with, nonetheless, Citizen Kane.
Yeah, good start.
31. And basically the second generation, Herrmann, Miklos Rozsa, Alex North, they brought to Hollywood a new sort of a idiom in music. Basically, they imported into Hollywood the modernist language, the 20th century music, as opposed to the late 19th century language that the previous generation used. And Herrmann, for example, it didn't use Mickey Mousing as Max Steiner would.
Now, and I want to make sure I have this concept. I'm going to use another example from later, from 1958, that kind of terminal point for this golden age, and a movie called The Vikings, which was actually had a soundtrack written by an Italian, Mario Nimes.
Nascimbene.
Yes, Nascimbene.
Exactly.
And there's a scene in that called Dancing the Oars, where Kirk Douglas is literally jumping from one oar to the next outside this Viking ship, and the music matches beat for beat his landing on those oars. That's Mickey Mousing?
Yes, exactly. And that's a good example, because why 1938 as a closing date for the... Because that was... Well, actually, it was not this sharp transition, but I chosen 38 because it was the year with the there was a change in the contracts between the studios and Hollywood musicians. So basically, since 1958, Hollywood studios were not obliged anymore to have an in-house symphony orchestra.
Oh,
they
that's
could
a
chase,
major change, isn't it?
Yes, I think it's a good date to. You know, as a sort of a landmark of the classical period, because the sound of the studio symphony orchestra was so peculiar to that period. And so that year was the end of this habit. And from this period, so we have in the 1960s, more jet scores, more use of popular songs, and less use of the symphonic means as the, you know, the group performing the music. Besides, big spectacular movies. So in the 60s, and that's interesting you mentioned the Vikings, because the classical Hollywood styles could be listened in these big spectacular adventure films. So you could still listen to the old school in these films, while in contemporary films you would listen to jazz, to more, you know, chamber. They would use a chamber orchestra instead of a big, for example, in To Kill a Mockingbird by Elmer Bernstein. It uses sort of a little chamber orchestra, mostly strings and piano, not this big.
This is about 1960, 61? I
think 61 or 62. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Well, if we go back to 1933 and Max Steiner writing this music almost through written for King Kong, is there any kind of awareness in Hollywood, in the industry, that, oh, this is the direction to go? Or what happens after that? Why is it such a big breakthrough?
Oh, yeah, because I would say that Max Steiner's music saved the film, actually. Because the producers were very afraid about this, you know, King Kong puppet, because the actual protagonist of the film was a sort of a clay and furry puppet that was animated by this stop-motion technique. So you catch a frame, then you move the puppet arm a bit higher, then you catch another frame, and then you project the frame at 24 frames per second. You see the puppet moving. So it was a sort of a rudimentary animation technique. And the producer was very worried that people might laugh at this monster instead of be scared by them. And it was Max Steiner's score, actually, that gave the monster credibility, this sort of a sense of threatening and this sort of a...
So this is movie music that intensifies the scene, then. It doesn't play literally to the action like Mickey Mousing, but it has this kind of psychological affinity for the action.
Yeah.
And it's actually telling you how to feel.
Exactly. And also it gives a soul to the character, in this case to the puppet King Kong. Yeah. And so basically the film was a big success in Hollywood, and everyone realized that part of the success, a big part of it, was because of Max Steiner's scoring.
Did he use motifs at all to represent characters or situations?
Yes, yeah, because there was this sort of a Middle European thing of leitmotif. So basically from Wagner's opera. And so both Steiner and Korngold and the first group of composers, the first generation, they sort of introduced leitmotif and Hollywood scoring, and actually it was very functional for the movie because you can write a theme for each character, and then you can sort of retell the story with music, sort of a parallel retelling of the story musically with the leitmotifs and etc.
Did overtures ever catch on for films? Overtures, especially in the sense of having motifs that would later appear in the film and represent characters and situations?
Well, you mean the opening overtures?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Opening credit music.
Yeah, sure. Well, in the classical period, you would have 1 minute and a half, 2 minutes long opening credits. And generally, the opening credits set the mood for the film. And generally, you can hear the main theme or themes on the opening credits. So, for example, a noir film, for example, the Maltese Falcon, for example. The Maltese Falcon, we have this black and white opening credits with very contrasted lighting, so very sharp black and whites. And we have this ominous profile of the Falcon. And so, and there we have this ominous music by Adolf Deutsch. So in the opening credits, we have all the mood of the film. You know that we know that it is noir because of the lighting, because of the style of the music. We know that this Maltese Falcon, we see it in the opening credits. We know that this is sort of a precious object, but also, you know, powerful and sort of an object that is dangerous too. So there is all the sort of a plot of the film introduced visually, graphically, and musically in the whole movies.
So what happens after then? Who are the first to follow in the footsteps of Max Steiner with King Kong in 1933, as we get into 34, 35? I think, well, here's a contrast that seems to come to mind. 1931, you have the film Frankenstein.
Yes.
Which I think has minimal music.
Yes, just for the opening credits.
But by the time you get to 1935,
Five,
and The Bride of Frankenstein, the music is everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Because you can feel that there was this King Kong revolution in Hollywood. And so Franz Waxman's score for The Bride of Frankenstein is very rich in leitmotiv, very rich in descriptive effects, and it covers almost all the film. So it's a big difference from the previous films. And it's the same director, because was James Whale directing both the first and the second.
And very similar looks, of course,
exactly.
To the films.
But in those 4 years, there was a complete music revolution in Hollywood.
Well, we're actually going to hear some of the music and look further into this revolution in Hollywood film music when we return shortly. This is University of the Air. Gosh, you can almost smell the popcorn. We're so conditioned after 70 years of hearing. That's the fanfare, of course, that Alfred Newman wrote for 20th Century Fox. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Emilio Audacino, and he's telling us about the history of film music, but particularly as John Williams comes into it in the 30s, the very time that we're talking about. That fanfare that Alfred Newman wrote, how did that come to be written? Did somebody say, we just need a fanfare to start all of our 20th Century Fox movies?
Well, I think it's something that we can trace back to the silent film Nickelodeon, you know, this sort of a front store place where they project the film. And I remember reading that most of these, the bigger ones, had a sort of a band of brass outside of the door trying to bring people in. And so they would play this sort of a brass music, very showy brass music, to catch the attention and to bring people in. So I think this use of the fanfare music in Hollywood film could be a sort of an attention catcher, like the they used to have in the silent film. That's an hypothesis.
Well, we're all conditioned to it by now, I would say, long since. We get into we're talking about the 1930s in film, which, of course, is the decade that really ushers in the talkies. But also, I don't know how coincidental it is in terms of the way things turned out, but the 30s was a decade in which America got a lot of composers from Europe, largely for political reasons.
Yes, exactly. And, for example, Korngold basically said, I was saved by Robin Hood.
Yes, because, I've heard that.
And because he was preparing an opera in Vienna, in 38. And so basically this opera had some problems, some delays. And so he decided to accept this job in Hollywood. They sent a telegram and said, would you come here and see a new film about Robin Hood? And so first he said, no, I have an opera and I can't go. Then it was a sort of a delay. And then he decided to go to Hollywood and take a look at the film. And so he left with all his family. And he saw the pictures and he said, oh, this is an action picture. I'm sort of a composer. I am an opera composer. I'm not good at action scoring. That's not a film for me. And then he went home and listened to the radio, and he listened to the news that there was this Anschluss signed.
Yes,
in
that
Austria.
Germany had annexed, in effect, Austria.
Yeah, and so Korngold was a Jew. And so it was a problem for him to go back to Vienna, because the Nazis seized the town and Cornwell's properties. So basically, he accepted the Robin Hood job. And so he managed to bring, he had, I think, another son in Austria that was still there. He managed to have him moved to Hollywood. And I remember reading that his publisher in Vienna managed to smuggle all the Cornwell manuscript to Hollywood because otherwise the Nazis would have burned them. So basically, for this strange coincidence of Cornwell being in Vienna for Robin Hood, he said, I was saved by Robin Hood.
That kind of sums it up, doesn't it? We're going to get back to Korngold shortly, but by the time we get to the late 30s, we have really covered a lot of territory in terms of the development of film. And you think about the difference between film in 1929 and 1939. It's a difference between a silent film and The Wizard of Oz and yes. Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, you have the sound, you have the color, because we're talking about the first big Technicolor movies. So it's actually in those decades, there were a lot of changes, and technologically also stylistical changes.
Gone with the Wind, of course, is a period piece set in the Civil War.
Yes.
Was it customary up until that point for composers to provide period music for an historical piece?
Well, you can see the difference if you compare Rogers' scores of the late 50s and early 60s to the previous scores. I mean, Roger had a real philological approach. So when he prepared to compose the score to Ben-Hur, for example, or the other film set in ancient Rome that he did, he actually researched for the music of the times and tried to, for example, he would use ancient modes instead of diatonic system of contemporary music.
Lots of brass, it seems to me.
Yeah, exactly, because he said there were no strings in ancient Rome, of course. And so he would use harps and brass and trying to replicate a sort of the sounds that you would hear in those times. So basically, there was the philological approach that Roja mostly used. Before Roja, there wasn't actually this philological approach. So basically, the common language was the late Romantic music language.
Just no matter what.
Exactly. So there was not this, for example, the Seahawk, Korngold's The Seahawk. It's a film set at the times of Elizabeth I. And so with the war with Spain, the England against Spain. So there was at that time, Elizabethan times. But you have a late Romantic score. You have you have just a diegetic song that is sort of a reminiscent of the English modal songs of the period. But otherwise, the whole score is very late 19th century operatic in language. Well, in Gone with the Wind, there are some quotations of folk music. For example, you hear Dixie and other Southern American tunes, but mostly they are embedded in and otherwise,
just kind of alluded to.
Yeah, and otherwise they are embedded in what is a late Romantic score in language. Yeah.
Well, let's hear the opening, the main theme from Gone with the Wind, and see how that sounds in terms of, is it 19th century? Is it Hollywood in the 20th century? I have to admit, there's a lot of that music at the beginning that I would not have been able to identify as coming from Gone with the Wind until you get to Tara's theme, which yes. I always think of as this kind of wonderful two-step, mm-hmm. you know, in various forms, which is indelibly linked to Gone with the Wind.
Yes, yes.
Max Steiner wrote for King Kong and for Gone with the Wind. That's pretty versatile.
Yeah, and actually he wrote a lot. I mean, in 1938 and 39, when it was in the year he was working on Gone with the Wind, he was also working on another 7 films. And so actually,
7 films.
Yes, so 8 films with Gone with the Wind, and Gone with the Wind is a 2.5 hours of music.
Does it really that much out of the 3 hours of film time?
Well, actually, he had assistants. He had 4 or 5 orchestrators that helped him to, you know, he wrote in sketches to save time, and then the orchestrator would expand his writing for orchestra.
What's the prescribed way, if not always followed, of writing music for a film? Does the composer see the film with all of its dialogue and everything edited and then write to that? Or does the composer ever even look at the script?
Well, it depends. For example, Max Steiner didn't want to read scripts at all. So he said, when I see a script, I run miles away. Because he said, and I think he was right, that, for example, imagine when you read a book and then they make a film after the book. And sometimes you watch the film and you're a bit disappointed because mm-hmm. while you were reading the book, you imagine different faces for the characters, different locales for the settings. So for that reason, Max Steiner wouldn't read the script because he said, I want to see the visuals. The movie is a visual thing, and I cannot get the rhythm of the cutting, the editing from the script. And consider that Max Steiner had this style that was, well, music would be very, would adhere very closely to the visual. So he really needed to compose to the film and not. But for example, modern composers, not in the Hollywood tradition, for example, Ennio Morricone is mainly works from the script.
Does he?
Because his style is not this closely adherent to the visuals, and so he can compose from the script.
Well, with certainly very creative results in Morricone's
case.
Good, bad, and the ugly. I mean, that's something that was kind of a surprise, if not a shock, to everybody watching Westerns.
No, but it's different approach and different style because, for example, Morricone doesn't do Mickey Mousing, for example.
No, I would think not.
He does not believe in sync points. He says music has to follow its own flow. So if you compose too close to adherent to the visuals, you get fragmentary music. And that is not good for music. And so Morricone doesn't do Mickey Mouse.
Well, the sync points, too. I mean, given that things can change so much between the script and the final film, even in the edits after the filming has been done. I remember Malcolm Arnold got very upset as he wrote music for Bridge on the River Kwai, the opening scene there with marching, and it was somehow gotten out of sync with what he wrote for it.
Yes. It happened to Williams, for example, for Star Wars Episode I. And Williams also composes to the visuals, so he doesn't read script either because he said, I want to see the film, react to the film as a viewer would react. And so basically, you know, there is a big duel, actually, between the Darth Maul, who is the arch villain of the film, and the Jedis. And so Williams composed this sort of a balletic music piece mm-hmm. for this duel.
Well, it is sort of like a ballet.
Yeah. And that was a sort of a compact duel scene. And then after he worked on the music, Lucas got a sort of a advice from Spielberg that he said, I think this scene would look better if you do some, you know, cross-cutting. So don't have a 3-minute duel, but then duel, and then we see what is happening at the same time in another. So he basically modified all the cutting of the scene and transformed it into a cross-cutting.
So the music wouldn't match.
And so Williams had to adjust the music on the recording stage because it was too late to rewrite it. And so he said the orchestra, oh, drop from measure 7 to measure 12 and jump to measure 15 here. So it happens, yes.
I wanted to get back into Korngold for just a minute because Robin Hood was, I suppose, the film for which he is best known. And so you have this deeply classically trained European composer coming to this country and writing for Robin Hood.
Yeah, and again, we're talking about the philological approach to period film. Robin Hood is set in England, in medieval England, and it has a late 19th century Viennese score.
Well,
so actually, it's not a philological approach.
And this is where it gets interesting, because the 30s is the decade into which our subject, John Williams, is born. So the first movies he's seeing are going to have music like this.
And actually, there's an interview where he says that he loved going to the theater, to the film theaters, because of this lush symphonic music that you could hear at that times. And definitely, I think that this first generation of composers has been a great influence for John Williams. And basically what he did, what he has done, is to blend the first generation and the second generation. For example, Bernard Herrmann also had a great influence on John Williams. And he also is a big admirer of Alex North, second generation again. And it's sort of a blend the two generations, and he added a bit of jazz, because John Williams started as a jazz musician. I mean, in the 50s, he was a jazz pianist in New York, so he had a jazz background besides the symphonic background. And so sort of the interesting thing of Williams is that he blended the first Hollywood generation, the second Hollywood generation, added a bit of jazz in terms of harmonic chords and progressions. And he retrieved the classical Hollywood style mainly because he's the one who brought back the symphonic orchestra as the musical means to play in the film in a period where the symphonic orchestra was considered sort of outdated.
Yes, passé, right.
For example, that's a good example is Jaws. Jaws as is kind of a disaster movie because there was...
for the characters in it anyway, yeah. It was certainly a blockbuster for sales.
There was this... in that sense, of course. Well, there was this fad in the period. For example, you had Earthquake, you had Tower Inferno.
Oh, sure.
You had the Poseidon Adventure. And by the way...
Early 70s, yeah.
And all the three of them were scored by Williams, by the way.
Oh, did he do Poseidon Adventure, too?
Yes.
Okay.
And so basically, Jaws is a sort of a disaster movie because you have the classical plot of a disaster movie. There is a big menace on the community. Someone say, oh, there's a menace, we have to do something. And the authorities don't do anything because they are afraid to, you know, to spoil their business and so on. So the plot structure is real.
So the little man has to take on the big threat.
Exactly. And so it was a contemporary story in the early 1970s. And generally, this kind of film would have at least one pop song on its soundtrack, because from the 1960 on, Hollywood had to, you know, balance the box office income with some income from the recording.
Selling those soundtracks,
yes, exactly.
Yeah. Became a big business.
Yeah, because the situation was not very flourishing as it used to be till the late 1930s because of television and a lot of other reasons that we don't have time now to discuss. But anyway, they had to sell tickets of the movies, and they had to sell recordings and LPs and albums from the film. So generally, you would put pop songs to entice the young generation to go to the theater and to buy the LP.
Poseidon Adventure, There's Got to Be a Morning After. It was a Maureen McGovern, I think, that was the big hit from that one.
And also they had a sort of a... Yeah, for example, Poseidon Adventure had basically uses a symphony orchestra, but the kind of a musical style is, you can feel that is 1970s, because you also have the drum set and sort of a rhythm is that of the popular music.
Sure.
The new thing in Jaws is that it's a contemporary film designed to be a blockbuster that has no pop song on its soundtrack, but a symphonic score that is even Korngoldian in some sequence. If you remember the big chase out to the sea where there's the three men on the boat chasing the shark, you can hear Korngold-like fanfares there. And there's the montage sequence where you see all the tourists flocking to the island for the 4th of July. And that was the typical case where they would have used a pop song, typically. For example, like the Beach Boys. Because you had some Beach Boys
That's
song.
That's hard to imagine in Jaws.
And, and instead of that, you have a Baroque piece for trumpet, strings, and harpsichord. So it was a very against the tide
counterintuitive
choice.
Counterintuitive, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so basically he retrieved the symphonic scoring, and the most important thing, he retrieved this close adherence to the visuals that was typical of the first generation, Max Steiner. And in my book, I argue that there's an extensive analysis of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I argue that John Williams is a sort of a new Max Steiner in Raiders of the Lost Ark because of his clever and precise use of this sort of a, well, sometimes Mickey Mouse is seen as a derogatory term, but
sure.
I don't use that in that way. Mickey Mouse is a classical Hollywood technique in my view, and it requires great precision and dramatic sensitiveness from the composer. Yeah.
We're going to look at Raiders of the Lost Ark and other film scores by John Williams when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. Star Wars or Superman? Well, either way, of course, it's the work of John Williams, and we'll maybe get into the distinction between the two. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Emilio Audacino, who is telling us about Hollywood film music and also, in specific, the music of John Williams. And, well, it's very recognizable. Williams has been faulted for, you know, borrowing from Holst, borrowing from Stravinsky, borrowing from other composers, 20th century composers. But his style, nonetheless, is very distinct, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Is actually, he acknowledges these borrowings because basically it says that a film composer has to set a period, a mood, as an art director would do in a film. So an art director would quote from a late 18th century architectonic style. It would have a neoclassical style in the building and the scenery. And so in the same way, the film composer has to quote to give the mood. And the idea behind Star Wars was to have a very familiar sounding score for this film set in, you know, unknown worlds in the outer space. And so the idea was that music would be a sort of a emotional a familiar a reference point to balance that.
Well, and the thing with, as we get into, well, Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Superman too, really, come to think of it, those are all retro anyway. I mean, Indiana Jones is set in like the 30s.
Yes.
Star Wars is set emotionally in the 30s, like Buck Rogers. You
yes,
even have that,
yes,
that
yes.
Receding script at the beginning of it, you know, and the serial deal where it says Episode 6, even though this is the first film. And
also says a long time ago.
Yes, yes.
So it's,
far,
it's,
far away.
It's
got
like
that fairy tale and science fiction combined, which is an interesting concept too. And then Superman, of course, is retro again. Back to the 30s, regardless of when the movie is actually set.
Yeah, so you have this this idea of borrowing from the great symphonic repertoire is a way to revive memories in the viewers and the listener of their experience with symphonic music. For example, I remember as a kid, I don't think I was 3 or 4, I heard Richard Strauss opening to Das Spoke Zarathustra.
Mm-hmm.
And as a little kid, it was very impressive to me, this big orchestral sound. And then when I heard Star Wars or other big orchestral piece by John Williams, this sort of a memory from that moment when I discovered this big symphonic sound, mm-hmm, was sort of revived in me from my memory.
Well, and those interval leaps, too, at the beginning of Zarathustra and Superman and Star Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're related.
So I think this thing of using this retro symphonic style is a way to reconnect the viewers to their musical memories.
And with Star Wars, then, I guess Williams had no idea. I'm not sure about Lucas, but Williams had no idea that he was actually going to end up providing music for a whole series of films.
No. And now he has just signed for another films, virtually another three films.
Another Star Wars?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
The production started right now. It's due to be in the theater in December 2015.
Well, he has quite this, as we say, toolbox of music now to draw from to get things started.
It's a unique achievement. I mean, there's sort of I think it's a couple of dozens of hours of music so far. So the 6 films, and in each film there are 90 to 120 minutes of music. And now we're having another 3 films. And all of this composed across almost 30 years. So it's a unique achievement, not just in film music, but in music to core, I think, this big.
Well, Star Wars actually, especially in the later films, becomes kind of operatic anyway.
Yes, yeah. It's well, music is is everywhere in Star Wars. It's sometimes it's like, you could silence the dialogue and you could appreciate the film anywhere with the visuals and the music.
I'm a little curious about this wonderful scene where I think the music almost steals the scene. The little barroom scene in Star Wars, you have this kind of like Jewish klezmer band or something,
but of course the people
playing are all aliens with weird
heads. The Cantina Band.
Band.
Yes, yes.
Was that John Williams' idea?
Well, there was a discussion with George Lucas, and they had to write a diegetic piece again. Here we are with that term again, because they filmed this scene with this alien band playing this strange, outer space instruments. And so they had finally to decide what music they would play. And I said, well, what sort of music can an alien band play in a cantina in some unknown planet? And then Lucas said, imagine some aliens find a Benny Goodman score under a rock. and he never heard of Benny Goodman or this style of music. And so they try to interpret that music, to render that piece with their instruments. And so Williams composed this strange, Benny Goodman-like piece, a little awkward in there, in the style, in the accent, and in the rhythm. And I think it was a very good idea and very good solution to that.
Yes, cute and bouncy. In this case, yes, the music does match, obviously, the scene in the film. When we get to Raiders of the Lost Ark, what's his strategy there? Because, again, it's set in the 30s, and of course
yes.
you think of the 30s as a big time for adventure, not just in film, but in real life. Discovery, you know, and technology mixed.
Yes, and indeed, the whole film is designed as an homage to the ancient film, the old film, sorry, not that ancient. And so all the film is designed so as to be a retro piece. So the scenery, also the Spielberg style in terms of direction of actors, and it's very economical, very straightforward. Mm-hmm. If you compare, for example, that to Jaws or to Close Encounters, the sort of style in Raiders is very more essential. Like the for Ooh. Example, like Howard Hawks, the style that Howard Hawks would use in his adventure films. So everything is retro in Raiders, and the music particularly, because to me it's the most Max Steiner-like score Williams ever written, because there's a lot of Mickey Mousing, is, for example, more diatonic, more simple harmonically than Star Wars, so very straightforward mm-hmm. music as well. And it has great memorable themes for the characters. And, for example, Marion's theme, the love theme in Raiders, it sounds very much like a Max Steiner love theme from the 1930s. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So the whole package of Raiders is an homage to the old films and the scores very much.
A little bit of a tightrope, though, isn't it? Again, because of this danger of falling into self-parody.
Yes, well, it does much of self-parody. I mean, all the film, Old Raiders is a sort of a tongue-in-cheek film. I mean, it doesn't take itself seriously. And I think that is the great thing about the film. And the music itself is very... For example, if you remember the scenes when you see the Nazis arriving and you hear a very heavy bass trombone music with this heavy chord, bom, 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 bom. That's clearly self-ironic. It's not music taking itself seriously. So even the score has this quality of irony. Yeah.
And as he progresses beyond Raiders of the Lost Ark, I mean, you know, by the time we get into the 1990s, the mid-1990s, what are the demands on Hollywood scores and on John Williams? I mean, as Hollywood changes, does John Williams change?
Well, the good thing, one of the many good things, I'd say, about John Williams is that he's also very versatile. So in the book, I focus on his neoclassical scores, that was Star Wars and Raiders, and we can add Superman to that. But he can also write jet score, for example, recently Catch Me If You Can. He can write klezmer for The Terminal, for example. And he can write, you know, little chamber piece-like scores like Stanley and Iris. And or there's a beautiful romantic theme for piano for Sabrina, the remake of 1995.
Sure, that Harrison Ford movie, yeah.
So basically, I think that the neoclassical trend, John Williams' neoclassical trend, can be mostly located between 1975 and 1983. And then he continued to compose neoclassical score, for example, Hook, the Steven Spielberg 1991 film, has a great, I'd say, Korngoldian score.
Well, that would be appropriate, wouldn't it, for a swashbuckling kind of thing?
Yeah, that's pirate music, yes. So Williams sort of continued to move between his versatile side, so providing scores for any kind of film that a director would ask him to write music for, and the other neoclassical scores that it has recently produced are the Harry Potter, the first three Harry Potter films, this Tchaikovskian sound, and mostly the first
could
one.
Do worse as a model.
So basically, I don't think that nowadays neoclassical style is very popular in Hollywood, because, for example, the leading figure in Hollywood is Hans Zimmer now, and Hans Zimmer is not a neoclassical composer. He uses the orchestra, but he uses the orchestra because a big symphony orchestra can produce a big sound that can compete and blend with the aggressive sound design of contemporary Hollywood film.
Good point.
But because of this aggressive sound design, you don't have room anymore for a new neoclassical score that has leitmotifs, that has this, you know, refined musical writing. So basically what contemporary Hollywood action films require is pounding rhythms, big bass sound, and this kind of things that Hans Zimmer is very good at delivering, but that's not neoclassical scoring.
John Williams is also famous for writing marches. Do you have a favorite?
I'd say Superman, the Superman marches. I think it's the best one for me.
Emilio Agostino, thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you for inviting me.
A fascinating, if sort of lickety-split hour, looking at some of the music of Hollywood in the Golden Age and its influence on John Williams. I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air.